Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. Welcome in to the Storycraft Cafe. I'm your host, Hank Garner, and today I'm super excited to be joined by a great friend, Daniel Kenny, who is one of the most prolific authors that I know and one heck of a great guy. Dan, I got to looking. It looks like we did our first show together maybe about 7 years ago. I guess that sounds right. You know, time flies when you're having fun, but I think around that time you might have had about 10 books out, and now you're something like 4,000. I'm not sure. I lost count, but you, Dan publishes under Dan Kenny, Daniel Kenny, and Daniel Carson, three different names for different target audiences that he targets with his books, all phenomenal, all at different age groups. Welcome, Daniel. It's so fun to get to catch up with you again.
Oh man, Hank, I can't believe it's been 7 years. Isn't that incredible?
So crazy.
I was just looking back and thinking I'm coming up on my 10th year from having first published this fall, and then I think 12 years since I really started writing seriously. And you know, at the beginning, I mean, in some ways it seems like, oh my gosh, this has taken so long, but man, it goes by like that, doesn't it?
It does. And then you look back and you've got this incredible back catalog that you've kind of slowly and steadily, well, not necessarily slowly, but steadily building and just kind of accumulating this corpus of work. And that's one of the things that we're going to talk about today is, you know, keeping your focus on the thing when it doesn't necessarily seem, you know, like things are going the way you want. But then you look back and you're like, oh, look at this, you know, massive work I've accumulated. And you know, we were talking right before we went live about some family stuff that was going on and weddings and things like that going on. And, you know, you look back in hindsight and you just don't know, you know, where the time has gone. And you just kind of get so caught up in being in the moment that you kind of it's easy to lose sight of all of the amazing things that have happened along the way.
No, that's exactly right. And that's one of the things I want to chat with you about today.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of work over the last few years just trying to understand some things better. And I think one thing that was becoming clear to myself is that with each and every year, I am finding it personally harder to focus and to stay on task and to do really hard cognitive work, which writing is a perfect example of this really deep, cognitively challenging work. And so kind of my personal exploration led me eventually to the work of a guy named Cal Newport. And Cal is a professor of computer science, of all things, at Georgetown University. But, you know, back when he was in college, he started writing, you know, books. And he initially started from the perspective of how can students be more successful. And then eventually, as he became a professional, sort of moved into the realm of the professional world. And I think if you had to say, is there a theme throughout Cal's work? It's this idea of something is going on. In this, there's incredible technological innovation, but ever since sort of the digital world, a lot of people are finding it harder to focus deeply and do this cognitively challenging work. And one thing I think that's really interesting that you said there right at the beginning was we can get kind of lost in the moment, But if you look back, oh, wow, over 10 years, I've written a lot of books. And that's actually right. one of the points that Cal makes. And maybe that could be sort of an entry point for this discussion. But one of the things he points out is we are so busy right now, like in a frenetic way. We are constantly checking emails and replying to people and staying connected and getting notifications. And a lot of people have this idea that over the course of a day, they're involved in a lot of activity. And that seems to be driven, that frenetic pace, by this desire to like get a lot done. But weirdly, by doing all of this different activity, a lot of us aren't getting much accomplished.
Right.
And one of the tips he has is maybe we need to stop thinking in terms of hours and days and expand our time horizon. You know, one of the things he says is start thinking across a larger time horizon, like what could I accomplish over the next 5 years? And if you just start to reframe things that way, maybe the way we go about our daily work might change. So I'm going to pause and let you react to that, but maybe we could start there.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And a couple of things that you hit on there really resonated with me, because I am someone that really struggles with technology, because in so many ways, technology has given me the life that I get to live today. The work that I do, you know, working for a company like Dabble, I work on the internet every day. And it's only through the quantum leaps that we've taken in technology that allow me to do what I do. The way that we write and publish books are due to the technology that this technological age that we live in. The downside of that is that we're always connected to the rest of the world. And, you know, you could argue, you know, whether, you know, humans are meant to be connected to the whole world, or if we're meant to be connected to our little tribe, you know, of family and people that we're closely connected to, church groups, community groups, things like that. You know, that's a whole bigger discussion, but we do have to find ways to not only carve out for our attention, but then also to frame accomplishments in a way that is achievable, attainable. And, you know, when the sky is the limit, there it's harder to set goals and to measure accomplishments when literally there's no ceiling. You know, I guess, especially for people our age, you and me, that are kind of this Generation X, where we grew up, you know, as kids, we weren't connected to technology the way we were, but we were that generation that kind of brought it all in. Yep. And now our children, you know, it's like computers were something that when we were growing up was a thing to explore. And, you know, there was a lot of excitement. And to our kids, they're literally, you know, appliances. It's no different. A cell phone or a computer is no different than a toaster to them. You know, yes. So, you know, it's very difficult to keep things in a proper framework, I think. And I love that you have been wrestling with this and, you know, exploring this.
No, absolutely. In Cal's book, Deep Work, which if anybody's interested, I think that's the right place to start.
Yeah, and we'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, the premise is pretty simple, that, boy, we need to get back to doing deep work. And so the book starts off with sort of a portrait of John McPhee, who is this legendary writer for The New Yorker. By any, you know, way to define it, from the outside looking in, John McPhee was this unbelievably, extraordinarily accomplished writer. But Cal's point is, if you really looked at the day-to-day of how he wrote, it often looked like he was not doing much. In fact, the book opens with John McPhee spending like 4 or 5 days just like laying on a picnic table, looking up at the sky. He spent a tremendous amount of time just getting lost and being with his thoughts, and you know, the kind of pace that a middle manager today would look at and say, gosh, this guy isn't doing anything. Right?
Yeah.
Because he's not caught up in what Cal Newport calls sort of the pseudo activity of today's world.
Yeah.
And yet, if you look at John McPhee's career, by any metric, unbelievably accomplished. And so the challenge, I think, is for each one of us to sort of think to ourselves, okay, what is the most important work that I do? Now, for me, it's writing, and yeah, it's writing words. But this could apply to all sorts of people. You know, I think of somebody who's in sales. They need to talk to as many people as possible with actual sales calls. Sure. Now, I imagine in the world of sales, you could get caught up with like constantly being connected to people in a way that allows you to avoid the really hard work of making the next actual cold call that you have to make.
Right.
Because if you just concentrated and spent, my guess is 3 or 4 hours of complete deep focus, not being distracted, making those calls, my guess is the salesperson would get an extraordinary amount done. So for every single person in every sort of career, there is some one really hard, challenging thing that if you accomplish this day by day, week by week, month by month, you will be considered a success. So for me, that is writing words. It's writing chapters. And everything that is not that, I could argue that it's important at some level to my author business, but none of it is really moving the ball down the field.
Right. Now, it's fun to talk about these things and to, you know, try to keep our creative life in check. The other side of that is in today's world of publishing and indie publishing, especially, where if you're not publishing, you're not staying relevant in the algorithm and all of the things that you have to do to sell books. And none of us write books to not have anyone read them. We all need to, you know, keep the machine cranking, you know, in one way or another. That is, in a lot of ways, the antithesis of, you know, good self-care and good, these words are yeah, buzzing around. I'm trying to grab the ones that I really want. Sometimes the business of writing doesn't have anything to do with the creativity of writing. And sometimes you can create a lot of product and never say the things that you want to say. And I think that this is something that a lot of, especially first-time authors or new authors really struggle with, is the idea that there's a story that they want to tell. They want to get across something that they have learned, that they want to share this with the rest of the world. And, you know, and then when a lot of writers will tend to get jaded when they kind of realize that in a lot of ways, this is a business.
Yeah.
And sometimes the creativity gets lost. How do you, as someone who has been writing and publishing for a dozen years now, but who still deeply cares about what he writes and publishes, how do you find that balance?
Yeah, so this is really good. And it actually it leads right into Cal's newest book. Okay. So his newest book is called Slow Productivity. And he's just kind of building off of the idea of deep work. And I'm not getting paid by Cal here. I just think it's super relevant. So basically, sure. He has three ideas in slow productivity that build off of this idea of deep work. Number one, do fewer things. Okay. So right now, the writer, we have to write words, and then there's all this businessy stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, but be honest about all of the other businessy stuff and really be clear about what are those things that have to get done. But then prioritize the doing of the most important thing, which is the writing. Okay,
right.
Number two, and this is a thing I'm really interested in talking to you about. He says, work at a natural pace. Work at a natural pace. So I want to explore this with you a little bit when it comes to the idea of writing. Okay.
Okay.
So when you and I think of sort of the pre-indie publishing revolution, traditional sure. successful novelist, okay, mm-hmm. that person was generally speaking publishing how often?
One book a year, sometimes one book every 2 years.
Yeah. So the really hyper, maybe the genre, you know, maybe more formulaic was writing yeah. one a year, maybe the more literary, maybe once every 2 to 3 years, right?
Sure. Yep. That's fair assessment.
And that was considered a really natural pace. Okay. Right. So think about 40 years ago. You've got a writer who is doing research, going to the library, thinking of their story. Now they're writing it down or they're typing it out on an actual typewriter, right?
Right.
And they're trying to get it to a point where they feel comfortable sending it to an editor. Maybe that means they have to retype certain pages, type it twice, cross out things, write it in the margins. They finally have this big thing.
Right.
And they send it across the country to New York. And it takes a week. And then the editor gets it and goes through it by hand. Mm-hmm. And it takes them a long time. And then they put it in the mail and they send it back. And now the poor author has to go through it and literally type the whole thing over again. Correct?
Correct.
And then they keep going through this process. And voila, at the end of the year, they've got a book. Now, that would have been the natural pace for a really successful novelist and the kind of novelist that most people would have said, man, they are putting out a lot of books.
Right.
Okay. Now, fast forward to the year 2024. Computer word processing allows you to type and edit as you go very quickly. Mm-hmm. You can do research. You don't have to go to the library. You can do all that very quickly. You email it to an editor. They can work in your document. They right. can email it back. Boom, boom, boom. By putting the same amount of effort that you would have done as the novelist 45 years ago, I think you can make the argument that working at the same natural pace, you could still probably do 4 books a year. I would argue that. I would argue with the technology that we have today and the yeah. way that we can leverage it, working at the same natural pace as the novelist 45 years ago, my guess is you could probably do 4 of those books today without working harder.
Okay. Right. Right.
So to your point, there's this incredible technology that we have, which can help us leverage for more productivity. The question is, how do we marry those? Right.
Sure.
And everything I just told you are the ways that that technology really allows the writer to be much more productive. But let me tell you the parts of technology that do not help the writer be more productive. I'm typing, ding. Oh, I'm going to check my email. Got it. Typing. Oh, man, what's on Facebook? Typing. Oh, text from my wife. Typing. Oh, I just want to take a quick break. Oh, that's interesting. None of that's helpful.
Right.
And I think what's happened, I can't speak for everybody. I can just speak for people who are like me. I know there are people who are, gosh, they never get distracted by anything. But I'm telling you, there are people at Google and Facebook who are far smarter than me or you or most of the writers we've ever met, whose goal in life is to get us to check that notification.
Of course.
Like, that's their whole mission in life.
Yeah.
Like, these idiots didn't grow up to want to be astronauts like the smartest people in our country did 50, 60 years ago. No, 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 no. They're working for Google and Meta just to annoy us to death. And that's what the smartest people in the world are doing now.
Yeah.
And they're really, really good at it.
Yeah.
So
digital crack.
No, totally. So I think, like, we kind of have to have honest conversations with ourselves.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. If I orchestrate my life correctly and I get to the library when it opens at 9 o'clock and I start writing at 9:05, I'm a good typist. My chapters are about, in the Hope Walker Mysteries, are about 1,850 words long. How long do you think, if I'm completely focused, it takes me to write that chapter?
Probably under 2 hours.
Under 2 hours.
Yeah.
Never longer than 2 hours. I mean, honestly, if I'm focused, it's an hour and 20 minutes to an hour.
Right. Right.
And that would be the case for most people who are good typists.
Mm-hmm.
Hank, that's an hour and a half.
Right.
So now the question is, how many professional writers consistently write a chapter a day? Or are there a lot of people who, like me, make a lot of excuses a lot of the time for why I wasn't able to write a chapter today?
Yeah. Yeah. So have you found little tools, little things that you do that help you maintain your focus and to, you know, because you've had this honest conversation with yourself. Okay. Yep. We're talking an hour and a half of my time. What am I doing to make sure I hit that? And what things can I remove, or at least, you know, release myself from the distraction long enough to do? Have you found things that yeah. work for you?
Yeah. So I think there's two things to consider that could be applicable to other people. Number one, try to understand how you write. And I'm going to get into this a little bit more when we talk about drafting, if you've got time for that.
Sure.
But I think it's really, really important for everybody to sort of understand themselves. For instance, I have been online where I've heard the advice of certain writers who write like 20 books a year.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them have a certain personality that I probably don't have. These are people who say stuff like, you just got to put your butt in the chair. You just got to do it every day. And I think these people are just totally badass, hard ass people, right?
Right.
And they probably, their brains probably work differently than mine.
Yeah.
One thing I discovered when I came across a few years ago the work of Becca Syme, who was this incredible coach who works with the StrengthsFinder, the Gallup's Clifton StrengthsFinder. And she coaches a lot of authors on how to know yourself better, how to know what your strengths and weaknesses are, and then leverage your strengths to become a better author, a happier author, a more productive author. And one of the things I learned, which was not a shock to me, that of my top 10 strengths, The first six are all thinking strengths. Thinking. There's this portion of the Clifton strengths that has to do with responsive, like execution skills. Mm-hmm. And all of those for me are at the very bottom. I've got none of those. Those are not strengths for me. So I'm probably not the person who can just say, you just got to sit down. You just got to do it. You know, toughen up. You know, that doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
What I need is I need a lot of time thinking. Right. So I can talk about other things, but what I've basically figured out is that for me to arrive at the library at 9 o'clock, ready, focused, I mean, I have to have a good night's sleep. I have to have proper nutrition. I have to be consistently exercising. In other words, I need to manage my energy.
Right.
And then the previous day, I need to have done things like taken walks and had, you know, the mental space just to think, just to think about, okay, what's the next part of my story? That's me. I need a lot of thinking time. And if I've managed my energy correctly and I've done the enough thinking, then when I get there at 9 o'clock, that's half the battle. Okay. The second part of the battle is sort of what I do when I'm working. Okay, I have to have my phone off. It's important for me not even to connect to the internet at the library. Like, do not even connect. And in a perfect world, there are no tabs open and all I have is my work in progress. And I've got a couple pages of loose leaf that I have some notes for myself on story characters and things like that.
Yeah.
So if I've managed my energy and I've done the required amount of thinking that somebody like me needs the day before, and I arrive at 9 o'clock and I have everything shut down, then I'm telling you, give me an hour and a half, 2 hours at the max, I will have my chapter done. And here's the thing. If that's all I ever got done, and I did that 4 or 5 days a week, every week, just about every week, I mean, that adds up to a really big number over time.
Yeah, yeah, it does. And I have found that you and I are we're brothers separated at birth, I believe, but because I am the same way. I have to have everything shut down. I have to remove all distractions. If I have my laptop, I have to put it in airplane mode or whatever, close everything down. Or what I found that is really working for me lately is I bought a Bluetooth keyboard and I have an Android tablet. It's just a kind of a low end tablet, but it's 10 inches. It's fairly decent size. And I have nothing but my writing software installed on a Dabble. That's all that's on it. And I don't connect to the internet and, I just pop it open and it's just my writing. And like you, I can just burn through a chapter, you know, and switch my phone off. And it's amazing what happens when you just isolate yourself with just you and the story. You talk about the thinking through the story and giving yourself the space to kind of work through that. Are you, do you plot out your story ahead of time, or are you more in the pantser camp? Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Yeah. So if you want to, we can get into the next part of our conversation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I think this will become relevant here. And one thing I told you is I have now at this point, I have sort of a process I go through, which I remind myself of when I'm drafting a story. It's one way to do it. And I was just thinking it might be good to share just in case it could be helpful for somebody else out there. Now,
absolutely,
this, of course, is not the right way to do it. But sometimes you're just looking for a way to do it.
Exactly.
And this could be a way to do it. So let's just jump into that if it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So let's start with your first draft, draft number one. And I call draft number one, finding your story. Finding your story. And to me, finding your story is all about telling yourself a story.
Mm-hmm.
So I write a lot of mysteries, and this is right. particularly relevant here.
And your Hope Walker mystery series, I just saw on Amazon that you've got with some pre-orders up to 15 in that series now. Is that right?
Yeah. So I just put on, you know, I had put up some long, long pre-orders, you know, for just to get some ducks in the row. Sure. I'm on, we have 11 books, full books out and one novella. And then book number 12, my readers are anxiously awaiting but it's coming soon.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So I write a lot of mysteries.
Right.
So, you know, I have some ideas, but oftentimes it's not until I get to the end of draft one that I really understand the mystery and understand the story in a way that I'm like, oh yeah, now I understand the story. I'm finding the story. Now here's the deal. People need to find the story however it works for them.
Sure.
Right. There's a million ways to do this. You could find the story by outlining the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't even get wrapped up in the, you know, the plot or pantser thing. Cause to me, it's literally all the same thing. It's right. all, how do you find your story? That's the question, right? How sure. do you find your story? And Stephen King finds his story by moving his fingers.
Right.
That's how he finds his story, because he is what we call a pantser. But that's not totally true. Because you know what Stephen King does every single day in Maine? He takes really long walks.
Yes.
So he doesn't just find the story through his fingers.
Right.
He is finding his story by taking those long walks. You know, James Patterson famously writes out very detailed outlines. So
yeah.
he's finding his story by outlining, but outlining is writing. I mean, it's all the same thing.
Yeah.
For me, I do a lot of walking and a lot of thinking, and I just need to. So before I start moving my fingers, I do a lot of writing things on a tablet and bouncing things around and thinking, mm-hmm. whatever, who cares?
Right.
Whatever it takes, by the end of that first draft, you have finally told yourself a story. Okay.
Yeah.
Now we go to draft number two. Draft number two is where we make it not suck. And draft number two is telling somebody else the story. So just because at the end of draft one, you have found the story doesn't mean it's super coherent for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So draft number two is where we go through and we do things like in a mystery is like, oh, that didn't make sense to have that here earlier. Now that I know how it ends, I need to fix this little part. Now that will be coherent. In our first draft, we often call the same character by like different names because it's just like moving as we go. And so we're cleaning up little things like that. In a lot of first drafts, I don't know about you, but I think a lot of times writers leave themselves little notes.
Yeah.
Like, oh, I don't know what this is, but if I go to the internet right now and look, it's going to derail me. So parentheses, look up this later, right?
Right.
And right. so you're cleaning up all those little things. I don't think the job on the second draft is to make this a great work. It's just to make it not suck and to make it coherent for somebody else.
Right.
And that's the job of draft number two. Now we get to draft number three. And this, I think, is where the newer writer, once they're here, they can say, okay, how can I make this good? This is where we try to shine it up a little bit. And this is very particular to me. So this may not jive with somebody else, yeah. but I think it could be helpful. So let me give you my checklist that I'm looking at when I go through draft number three. Number one, voice. Every author has to figure out their authorial voice. What is that? And here's the way I think of that. What is that thing that they do that they are just particularly good at? And typically, you're going to figure this out. If you don't have a sense of it yourself, I think you're going to figure this out by the way readers react to what you do.
Right.
So for instance, apparently the thing my readers, for instance, of the Hope Walker mysteries really like is sort of the dialogue and the banter amongst sort of the main characters. And in particular, the dialogue and banter between Hope Walker, the main character, and her best friend, Katie. So if I have sort of a superpower, so to speak, it has something to do with the dialogue, the banter, the humor that's part of that. And in particular, as it relates to the main character and her best friend. So as I go back through draft number three, you have to know what you do well and then remember to do it. So I'm going back through the story and I'm like, okay, I got to remember to do my thing. And I can't go too long. There can't be big stretches where I don't do my thing. And sometimes I'm like, oh, I was trying to do my thing, but it was kind of lame. So I got to punch it up.
Right.
Like whatever your voice is, whatever you do particularly well, remember to do it. So I'll give you another example. It's not for me. I know a writer. She loves food in the sense that she's like a foodie. Like she likes nice food and she's so into it that makes its way into her fiction. And the way she describes food, it's incredible. And her readers love it. Now, maybe that's not for you. It doesn't matter. This author is killing it. And her readers love the way she describes food. Maybe for another author, it's the way they do fight scenes. Whatever.
Yeah.
Everybody's got, I think, something in particular they do well. And so I think the first order of business on draft three is make sure you're doing what you do well, well. Okay? Number two, I think you need to look for repetitions. So every author has repetitions. They're invisible to us. It's very hard for us to see them. We're using the same phrases over and over again. We're using the same words over and over again. Most authors have things they do too often over and over again. And what I have found is that depending on the project I'm on, I all of a sudden get new repetitions. So I have sort of my general cast of character repetitions, phrases I use too much, words I use too much. And then all of a sudden I'll get to a new project. I'll be like, why am I using this phrase or this word? And so the second thing I do to polish it up is I'm trying to find as many repetitions as I can. Okay. Number three, chapter endings. I think chapter endings are incredibly important.
Yes. And
in reading a lot of fiction, I'm really surprised when authors don't pay more attention to their chapter endings. I think one of the things that like the finest genre writers have in common is they're clearly paying a lot of it. To me, I think they pay a lot of attention to chapter endings because you've just gotten to the end of this, this big section that we call a chapter, and maybe you're getting tired, and then boom, they get you and they propel you to turn the page.
Right.
And so I would implore everybody to really pay attention to their chapter endings and ask the question, okay, what can I do with this final page or this last paragraph that is going to compel my reader to have to turn the page?
Right. And in the I'll just interject this, in the modern era of digital publishing, especially if you have a book that's in Kindle Unlimited, you literally can tell how far people make it through your book. That's and right. if you don't have people that are going 100% through your book, maybe it's because you aren't landing those chapter endings that make them want to continue reading. And that is ultra important.
No, that's right. I love Harlan Coben. Yeah. He's amazing. I am not as good of a writer as Harlan Coben. Okay. Now, I could either just accept defeat or I could say, but you know what? Over time, I'm going to continue to try to get better at my craft. Fair enough. But what do you do if you're just at the start of this journey? Do you just throw your hands up and say, oh, I'm not as good as Harlan Coben?
Yeah.
No, no, no. You may not be able to get your entire chapter as good as a Harlan Coben chapter. But maybe, just maybe, if you spend a lot of effort intentionally trying to make the last paragraph kind of gotcha, maybe at the very least you could start there. Yeah. And I think solid, actionable advice.
Yeah, and there's a reason that Harlan Coben has, 40-some-odd books that have been turned into Netflix series, because he does nail that, the whole arc of the chapter, like a television episode, draws something's happening in each chapter. There's a reason to begin the chapter. There's something that happens. There's a reason to end it and a reason to continue. And
that's right.
That's something we can all learn from.
Okay. I've got a fourth thing for the checklist. So we're in draft number 3. We're trying to make it good. We're shining it up a bit. We're paying attention to our voice. We're paying attention to repetitions. We're paying attention to chapter endings. And I've got one more thing, a fourth thing. And I call it that one thing. What do I mean? I think it's very hard for a writer who is trying to make a career of this to get better at all of the things with each project. I mean, we're going to try our best.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's practical to believe we're going to get better at all of the things. But I would challenge each and every writer to try to get better at least at one new thing with each project. This might come into the area of what we might call like deliberate practice. So, the violinist who's trying to get better, they have to do a lot of deliberate practice. Well, if you and I are being honest, the writer, for the most part, they're trying to write new words. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not exactly the same as deliberate practice. But I do think with each project, maybe it's helpful for us to try to practice one new thing. So let me give you an example. I just mentioned that I love Harlan Coben. I wish someday somebody would say, I love the way you write. I mean, it's kind of like Harlan Coben, but you're your own person. Like, that would be the most amazing thing, right?
Right.
So one thing I did this summer was I took a Harlan Coben book I really liked. And what I said to myself was, I really want to get better at what I call the connective tissue of dialogue. Mm-hmm. Okay, so my dialogue words are pretty good, right? Like, that's where I kind of shine. But I still think I struggle sometimes with what I call the connective tissue that kind of connects the dialogue. In other words, how to use dialogue tags, how to use help me out here, the physical, what would you call it? The physical behavior.
Yeah, the
I'm not saying the word right.
Yeah. I'm drawing a blank too, but the actions that you tag with. Yeah.
Yeah. The nonverbal communication, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Just how all of that works together. Like, there's still plenty of times when I'm going back through my book and I'm like, oh man, that dialogue is funny. That is witty. That's good stuff. But I know that the rest of it, it's just not.
Yeah.
And then, you know, okay, so I have an awareness of it, but then how do you get better at it? Well, you gotta study people who are better at it than you. So I was studying Harlan, and I was going through his book, and I was circling all of these things I was seeing that I thought were really good examples, right? And then once I circled them, I wrote them out on a big sheet of paper. And then I just started studying them. And before I would write, I would kind of go through a few of them. Then, and the hope is that over time I get better at those. It's possible that maybe that is my one thing for two or three projects. But let me tell you another thing I really struggle at. I don't have great prose. You know, I'm not the guy you want to come read if you want some incredible description of the moonlight sun. Like, I'm not great at setting the scene with really good prose. No one would read the Hope Walker Mysteries, I think, and say, oh, that's an example of fine American prose. They just wouldn't do it. So maybe on my next book, or in two books, that's the thing I'm really working on. But I think if you choose at least one new thing to work on each project or each group of projects, I think over time, that way, you really give yourself a chance to get better.
Well, and I will say this, you were talking about voice earlier, and there's your author voice, and then there are your character voices. And one thing that I will say about the Hope Walker series is that your character voices are so spot on. And you know, you've got 12 stories that you've told about Hope and her friends and family. These characters are more than alive at this point. And I can read a Hope Walker series and I can tell exactly when Hope's talking, when Granny's talking, when you know, any number of characters, you know, and those that is a such an accomplishment, that, yeah, I understand the things you're talking about and the things that you want to get better at, but you have so absolutely nailed those characters at this point that you don't need those dialogue tags almost. I know those are things that we all want to do better but having the character voices nailed so strongly that I can go through the story and I know exactly who's talking, and those dialogue tags kind of disappear because I've kind of fallen into the character. That's what every writer hopes for.
No, and that's a great point. It really is. But here's the deal. I am now at a point where I can make a living with my fiction, and it's taken a long time to get here, and that's great.
Yeah.
And the things I'm doing, I want to keep doing. But, you know, someday, if I'm good enough, I want a book in an airport.
Yeah.
You know? Sure. And not for pride, because listen, I know exactly who my readers are right now. Mm-hmm. And that's awesome. And thank God I figured out a way to make a living with my fiction. I think it's a blessing. But someday I would like to expand my readership.
Sure.
And I think to do that, I just have to keep trying to get better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So we've done your first three drafts, and now you're ready for draft number four, which is the draft where you make it great. And I personally believe that to make something great or as good as it can be, you have to work with an editor. So for me, once draft number three is done, I then send it to my great editor, and she and I work on it after that to bring it to completion. And like I said, hopefully make it great, or if not great, as good as we can.
What is that whole process? What kind of time frame are we talking about from Hope Walker chapter one, draft one, to, you know, hopefully getting it back from your editor at draft four? What's that time frame look like for you these days?
Well, Hank, one of the challenges I've had is, you know, I'm not only a father to eight kids, but just sort of the way work has worked out between my wife and I'm sort of the one who does the majority of the sort of after school parenting and cooking. Sure. I've also been teaching full time for the last 5 years. And so
5 years.
Yeah.
Wow. And so
I'm just not exactly sure how to put a time on that, but here's what I do know. I am finally at the end of this school year, retiring from teaching, so that I can write. Thank you. So I can write full time. And I do say retiring because I work at a great school. There's no reason to leave it.
Yeah.
You know, to go someplace else. I mean, they do a great job of making it a good place to teach. So it really is retiring. I'm finally at a position with my two pen names where I can do this full time. So that being said, I would anticipate going forward that it will generally take 5 weeks to draft the first draft of a Hope Walker mystery. And then a week to a week and a half to get it to the point where I can send it to my editor. So I think going forward, from the time I start a Hope Walker mystery to the time I send it to my editor, probably 7 weeks. That's my guess. Yeah.
That's pretty great. I want to touch on something for just a second before we go. And your time teaching, I think is a lot of new authors. I'm thinking back like a decade, 11, 12 years ago when I first started as well. There was a lot of talk about like Nicholas Sparks and the way he broke in, and, you know, he wrote this book, the Notebook, and there was a bidding war, and, you know, he wound up with $1 million advance, and a lot of new authors see stories like that. And that's wonderful to encourage people, but I think a lot of people will get the wrong idea about the reality of being a working writer. And you know, a lot of people have day jobs, of course, and then they start to resent that day job because they feel like that thing is standing in the way of them pursuing their dream. When in reality, and I think you will attest to this because the way you talk so glowingly about the school that you've taught out and that you're retiring because now you've gotten to the point where you can replace that, that the day job is really a blessing that enables you to pursue your creative endeavors, not something standing between you and your creative endeavors. Because like we talked about earlier, honest to goodness, about an hour and a half to 2 hours a day is really what you're spending on the writing. So this 8 hours you're spending at the day job is not preventing you from getting it done. It hasn't stood in your way. It's enabled you to get to the point that now you can take that next step. Could you talk for just a second about keeping those different areas of life and those different responsibilities in their proper order so that you can maintain the balance in life that will allow you to continue to be a creative person?
Yeah, that's, I actually think you kind of said it perfectly. I think one of the things we have to keep like asking ourselves is, why are we doing the things that we do?
Right.
So for me, I know that when I'm in right relationship with God and my wife and my family, in other words, when I'm keeping things focused on my relationship with God and my relationship with other people, that is when my life works best.
Right.
Ultimately, That's my definition of the good life. Now, along the way, I want to do the thing that I think I was uniquely suited to do. But man, if we chase those things at the expense of the main thing, which I'll be honest, I would argue for everybody is family and relationships. I just would. I'm happy to have that argument. But if we chase something at the expense of that other thing, then what are we doing? I have 8 kids. I had to have a job. Yeah. Like, there's just no way for this to work. I couldn't just tell my wife, hey, you know, the 2 credit cards that you don't know about that I already maxed out to get this small business running. What if we open 3 or 4 more and I just sit at home and do this? No, like we're adults, right?
Right.
You gotta, if I was at the point where I am now and I was working full time and my kids knew that I had done it at the expense somehow of our family having enough, or if it had overly stressed out my marriage, what's the point?
Right.
So I think it is the rule, not the exception. John Grisham is the exception.
Yeah.
He's just probably a hell of a lot more talented than you and me. And it's okay to accept that.
Right.
Like Gary Vaynerchuk always says, he's like, I love basketball. I was not going to play in the NBA.
Right.
They were not going to pick the 5'5" Jewish kid from, from New Jersey to play in the NBA. It's okay if we are not as uniquely unicornish as some of these, you know, outliers. And so what does that mean? It means for almost every other person trying to make a living in the arts, at some point, you got to have another job. Right. And it's not the thing, like you said, that's standing in your way. It's the thing that's actually allowing you to pursue your dream.
Right. Right. And Kenny, I think that's a great place to wrap this up. What's your latest release that we can send people to go pick up? Hope Walker number.
Yeah. I mean, obviously if you've never read my stuff, start at number 1, A Hopeless Murder. You will find out really quickly if this is for you or if it's not for you. You know, if you are the kind of person that likes Janet Ivanovich's Stephanie Plum books, then I think there's a fair chance that you will like my books.
Yeah.
Which is not to say they are just like those books, because I am not Janet Ivanovich and I am not as good as her. But if you've read all of her books, come over and read mine. I think you'll like it.
Absolutely. We'll put links in the show notes to make it easy for folks to find those and your 4,000 other children's books that you write under Daniel Kenny as well.
Yeah, you might want to check out either the Math Inspectors or the Science Inspectors. Those are my big sellers in the kids' world.
Yeah, and I also love the Pirate Ninja series.
I do too. I'm still working on those. It's one of those things where there's something there. We just haven't fully unlocked it, but I'm still working on that. And I kind of think that someday, like in 10 years, I'm going to look back and we finally figured out how to do that series right. Because whenever I talk to parents who have kids of a particular age, they just like those stories. Yeah. So I'll keep trying.
Absolutely. Dan, always fun catching up. Thank you for sharing all the writerly wisdom with us that you have today.
Thank you, Hank. You're the best.
See ya. That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing.
Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.